President has signed top secret executive order 2579 to take all necessary measures to neutralize Soviet agents in the continental United States.
Today in Studio 360, a TV show about spies, created by an actual spy.
It just became part of me, and I lied all the time. Every day I was lying constantly.
I'll try getting some truth out of Joe Weisberg, creator of the TV series The Americans. Plus, do Pharrell, Billy Joel, and Beyoncé have a songwriting superpower, a sixth sense?
The received wisdom is that the senses travel along five channels, that there's no intercommunication, and that turns out not to be the case.
Synesthesia, a neurological condition that makes you see sounds, hear colors, and every second pop star suddenly seems to have it. I'm Kurt Anderson. That and much more is ahead in this hour of Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Right after this.
Support for Studio 360 comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson.
I dreamed there was an Emperor Antony.
Later this hour, I'll talk with America's most acclaimed young playwright, Terrell Alvin McCraney, who is amping up the sex and adding some voodoo to the other Shakespeare tragedy that ends with lovers killing themselves, Antony and Cleopatra. I didn't really need to say spoiler alert, did I? Anyhow, that's later this hour. But first, the protests sweeping Venezuela, started by university students a few weeks ago, have turned deadly as the government violently cracks down. More than a dozen people have died. Food shortages and lawlessness are rampant. Barricades are popping up all over Caracas, some erected by protesters, some by the government. One of those blockades is set up just two blocks away from Henry Dartanay's house. He is the lead singer of a big-deal Venezuelan rock band called La Vida Boheme. The band's second album, Será, came out just after the death of Hugo Chavez a year ago. It won the Latin Grammy for Best Rock Album last year and has now become sort of the unofficial soundtrack to the protests. Henry Dartanay, welcome to Studio 360.
Hello, Kurt. Thank you for inviting me.
Things sound pretty chaotic. Where are you right now?
Well, right now I'm at my home here in Caracas, Venezuela, and I'm, like you said, I'm two blocks away from a barricade, but it's actually a citizen barricade.
Uh-huh.
What's been happening is that because of the protests and because of most of all because of the chaos, some people have taken it to, you know, they're scared that the government might attack. They have built barricades that actually are becoming quite a hassle, not only for government, but all of the citizens.
Can you leave the house and walk around and go shopping and do your business, or is it dangerous to be outside?
I could go outside right now, but it might get violent, and it's better to stay home. Going shopping has become a hassle because there's a lot of shortage of goods. Just yesterday, one of Venezuela's most important boxers, Antonio Sueño, died kidnapped and murdered, and this is something that constantly has been happening in Venezuela for many years. Just in 2003, we had over 24,000 violent deaths. The government has been, and I think that's something that has to be stated very clearly, the government has been acting very violently against the protesters.
Right.
So it's very chaotic, very anarchic, and I don't see any of the decisions that are being made. They have all been leading to a more violent escalate.
Your songs have been sung and played, I read, at a lot of the protests. I want to play a little bit for our listeners of Aún, which means still in English.
Las rodillas me tiemblan, pero no puedo parar. Quiero que mis hijos tengan lo que a mí me quisieron quitar. Aún, ay, aún, ay, aún, ay, aún.
I'm going to do my best to translate it to English.
Okay.
It is, now that my legs are tired of so much walking, I have left the mountain to never come back again. My knees are trembling, but I cannot stop. I want my children to have what they tried to take away from me.
Now, you wrote that song long before these protests began, but it sounds like it was a protest song when you wrote it a long time ago.
Yes, I think most of the things we're living now, I think, are it's all like the conclusion of something that has been happening for a long time here in Venezuela. For every Venezuelan, even if you're not involved in a political way, your life is at jeopardy, in a sense. And it's I think, more than a protest song, because it has become a protest song. I think it was something that it was in all of our heads, you know, being young people here in the country.
Right.
So I've been very politically active in that sense since the first time I started writing music, because I always thought it was like a responsibility, just by the mere fact that and there's not one government that has the right to attack its people. And I think that being in the 21st century, it saddens me to see that it's not only something that hasn't stopped, but now that we have the technology to see it's happening, it keeps happening, when more people should be aware of the crimes that are being not only made in the countries, but against humankind.
And when famous Americans, most famously Sean Penn, come to Venezuela and embrace Chavez and speak up for the Venezuelan government in the United States and elsewhere, how does that make you feel as a Venezuelan?
Well, I really respect them, because for them, when they see it, I think they're more in love with the ideal of the whole thing.
Yep.
But at the same time, I would invite them, you know, to try to live here even for a week to see how it is for all of us.
Yeah.
I do believe that this will come to a positive outcome, and a nonviolent one. But it all depends truly in the way we handle each other. There's 28 million people here in Venezuela, and not all of them are going to agree all the time. So, and we have to live with each other and respect each other and try to build a country that is good, at least, if not good for everyone, at least a country where each and everyone has a chance to build themselves and realize themselves as human beings and individuals.
Well, I wish you and your friends and your fellow citizens the best of luck.
Thank you so much, really.
Henry Dartanay is the lead singer and guitarist of the Venezuelan rock band La Vida Boheme. You can hear some of their songs at studio360.org. A few weeks ago, we offered you a new listener challenge. We call it
Wes Craven Presents Studio 360's Scary Short Film Fest.
The trick is to create a horror movie that's just 30 seconds long or less and scary enough to impress the modern genre's godfather, Wes Craven. Our overarching theme, courtesy of Mr. Craven, is young genius. And you've already sent us some pretty gnarly stuff.
My name is Jim Biglin from Philadelphia. I'm a high school art teacher. I'm actually in my office right now hiding from my students.
Jim created this creepy animation in which a young genius stabs himself with a quill pen and blood slowly, artfully oozes out of his head.
I was thinking of just all the tradition of the angst-ridden suicidal artists, you know, Van Gogh, Sylvia Plath. I want it to look really raw, so it's all hand-drawn. And then the background that's coming up is all these monsters and demons that are inside that are kind of raised up as all this angst and passion is released.
And Dan Waller from London, England, sent us this excellent story of Rory, a little boy who insists to his dad that there's a monster in the closet.
Dad, there's a monster in the closet.
No, there isn't. Get some sleep.
I think Rory is the young genius because he's the one that knows sort of where the monster is, and he tries to tell his dad. And his dad, as so often happens, we sort of dismiss what children say. But as his dad, not believing him, unfortunately, then pays the price.
Not my closet.
This is your last chance to send us your super short film. The deadline is Sunday, March 2nd at midnight. You can watch all the entries so far at studio360.org/scaryshorts. There are only a few dozen, so you, A, can watch them all in less than half an hour, and B, have got a serious chance to win. Wes Craven, the creator of Nightmare on Elm Street and the Scream movies, will be back in a few weeks to announce the winner.
Hashtag scary shorts.
Studio 360.
Coming up now in Studio 360, writing a TV show is hard enough, but imagine if you had to have every one of your scripts approved by the CIA.
I don't write anything about cover. Details about that, they won't let anything by because that's one of their real sore spots.
Joe Weisberg, former CIA agent and creator of the Cold War spy show The Americans. That's next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Support for Studio 360 comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson.
And the Oscar goes to...
If you're listening to this before Oscar night, I want to tell you about our newish annual tradition. It's a game we call Awards Bingo. If you go to studio360.org, we've got an interactive bingo card. Instead of squares for B5 or G62, our card says things like Ellen DeGeneres in spacesuit and expletive makes it on air.
It looked so easy. Oops.
And mispronounces Chiwetel Ejiofor.
Ejiofor.
That's a bingo.
You can print out the card or play online on your phone or computer, tablet, whatever. And you can join our live real-time awards bingo conversation on Twitter. I'm at KB Anderson. That's Anderson with an E. Our producers will be at Studio 360 Show. Hashtag Awards Bingo. And all the details are at studio360.org.
You just say bingo. Bingo! How fun!
Oh, Dad.
Yeah?
Mara got 2 goals and an assist last night versus L.A.
Did they win?
No, it was a tie.
I'm not going in today.
Philip and Elizabeth Jennings are an attractive suburban couple in the 1980s. Pure yuppies, right around the time the word yuppie was coined. They've got 2 kids, they run a travel agency together, they live in a nice house. Absolutely standard-issue people, except that Philip and Elizabeth are actually Russians, spies for the Soviet Union. They're characters in a show I really like called The Americans, which was created by a former American spy named Joe Weisberg. And he's here with me now. Joe, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you, Kurt. Great to be here.
So when you worked at the CIA, I was a friend of your brother's and didn't know he had this interesting brother, and I employed him. He is a famous liberal. Your parents are famous liberals. So was becoming a CIA agent an act of rebellion?
That's funny. If you ask my brother, that's the story he tells. And I don't think I can really say it's not true. I don't know that I was conscious of it. I wasn't thinking I'm going to rebel, but I'm sure something like that was going on beneath the surface. You know, in my head, what was going on was I took a course in college called History of the Soviet Union, taught by a guy named Wolfgang Leonhard, who had been an East German. And it really influenced me, and I started becoming more and more of an anti-communist and more of a Reaganite and wanting to fight the Soviet Union. And I think that started tying into the past where I had read a lot of John le Carré novels and wanted to be a spy, and it all sort of came together.
So you recruited people here, right?
No, I went through the training program, which is a very long and involved training program, and I did a lot of assignments in headquarters on different desks, and then I ended up leaving before my first assignment abroad. I never recruited anybody.
And how come? Why'd you quit?
At the time, what I sort of told myself, I had a lot of personal things going on. My father had become ill. I took a leave of absence to go take care of him when he was dying. I sort of went back after that for a summer, and I just felt that I had kind of lost my desire to go live abroad and do this job. But as I look back at it now, I think I'd really lost faith in what they did, that I had seen firsthand the kind of people they recruited and the intelligence they provided, and that it was all kind of BS, that the agents weren't worth anything and the intelligence they were providing was not valuable to the U.S. government. But what you really did do to collect that intelligence was ask all these people to really risk their lives for a lot of nothing. And I think I was kind of maybe unconsciously aware of that and didn't want to do that job.
As a CIA operative, you had to lie a lot. And then you started writing fiction. Lots of fiction writers have talked about that fiction is a matter of lying professionally. Do you see that kinship?
It always felt completely different to me. I actually wrote fiction from the time I was a kid. I started when I was about 12 years old. I wrote my first short story, somewhat troublingly called The Midlife Crisis Exploits. I still worry about that a little bit. But I never felt like I was lying when I wrote fiction. I just felt like I was telling stories and in a lot of ways trying to get at the truth when I was telling stories. But when I joined the CIA, I had a lot of concerns about it at the beginning. I thought to myself, can I actually lie to people about what I do, about my job?
Like your friends?
Yeah, my friends, although a couple of people in my family knew. Nobody in my extended family knew. And can I lie to them? And will I be able to do this? And then I joined and I started. And it took about a month. And then I was just completely used to it. I never had any doubts about it again. It just became part of me. And I lied all the time. Every day I was lying constantly. It just became really second nature.
Beyond what you needed to do because it got so easy?
I wouldn't say I went overboard, but I would say as opposed to some of my friends in the CIA who were sort of more insular and only hung out with other people at the CIA, I was put in a position where I had to lie more.
Interesting. So 4 summers ago, a whole bunch of Russian secret agents living in American suburbs are busted. How long was it before you thought, that's a TV show I can do?
I didn't think it and never would have thought it. What happened was probably even just a few weeks after that incident, my phone rang. And it was two guys named Daryl Frank and Justin Falvey, who are the heads of DreamWorks Television. And they said, I was working on a show then called Falling Skies, a science fiction show that they produce. And they said, Joe, what do you think about developing a television show based on this? And I thought, the honest to God truth is I thought in my head, I don't think that's such a good idea. But, you know, when the heads of DreamWorks Television call and ask you if you want to develop a TV
suddenly,
show.
Suddenly, maybe it's a good idea.
That comes out of your mouth. What is in your head doesn't matter. What comes out is that's a great idea. And I started wandering around the streets and thinking about how to turn it into something. And I don't know why it took 2 weeks, but after about 2 weeks, I thought, oh, well, you got to put it in the Cold War.
In addition to being a thriller and a spy story, it's also about this strange marriage where the couple doesn't really know if it's a real marriage or not, or what version of fake or real it's supposed to be. I want to play a clip. This is where Elizabeth confesses to her husband, Philip, that she's had an affair with an asset of theirs named Gregory, a former Black Panther.
When we got here, I was 22 years old. I was living in a strange house in a strange country with a strange man. And I met Gregory, and he was passionate about the cause. He was passionate about everything. He was passionate about me. And he didn't even want anything. He just believed like I did. He was the first person I felt I could really talk to. And I needed that. It just happened. It never really happened that way for us, did it?
That was Matthew Reese and Kerry Russell in a scene from the last season of The Americans. Joe, do you have a clear sense of how real the character's marriage is supposed to feel to them? Or do you go back and forth as you write more episodes and get deeper into it?
We have a clear sense that the marriage is the centerpiece of the show. And during the 15 years of backstory of this marriage, that a marriage had been arranged by the KGB, and that from the moment they met, which we showed in the pilot, Philip had been really in love with Elizabeth, and that she had not really shared that feeling for him. And that throughout the first season, they are negotiating and dealing with trying to have a real marriage for the first time because her feelings have changed.
And meanwhile, both of them are using sex with assets and potential assets as part of their jobs, which of course complicates the real marriage they're trying to forge.
Yes, of course. And their ability to compartment that or not is one of the interesting things in the series. And also, you know, one of the things in the show that is, you know, based on historical fact that seems like it might be a TV thing, but really the KGB encouraged their officers to use sex to gain intelligence information. And perhaps most startlingly of all, you know, this is a spoiler for anybody who hasn't seen the show. You might want to start humming for just a second. But Philip eventually marries his asset, Marcia.
Who is a secretary to an FBI official.
Exactly. And KGB illegals actually
really?
Did that. They actually married women. It was called usually secretaries to important men who the KGB wanted information from. So the KGB illegal would marry the secretary without the secretary having any idea the person was a KGB illegal. These marriages lasted for years, and the men would get intelligence from the secretary.
I'm glad you told me that because I really did think, yeah, nice. No.
Yeah. I wish we could have made that up.
Huh. So many spy shows and movies these days are all about technology and these computer devices and GPS and cell phones even. Is not having to deal with that make it easier for you to plot or harder or both?
It's much better for our storytelling for a couple of reasons. One is that there are no cell phones, so they can't solve a problem by picking up the phone. Philip can't pick up the phone, call Elizabeth and say, get out of there. And if you watch TV shows, there's a cell phone. I mean, in every crime or spy story, there's a cell phone in everything. It solves everything. It creates problems. It solves problems. We don't have that. So in a way, it's good. It makes the stories more complex and richer. But I also think that the espionage tradecraft of the early 80s, and this tradecraft is still in use. It's not like it doesn't exist anymore.
How they follow and how they lose people
exactly.
Are following them and all that.
Surveillance, yeah. The counter-surveillance, the dead drops, the brush passes, all this kind of classic espionage tradecraft is just more interesting. And again, they still use it now, but it also now they have computers and you can send things through encrypted email and things like that that solve a lot of these problems or alternate ways of doing things. You couldn't do it back then. And that's the tradecraft I studied. And it's just more fun. It's more visual. There's nothing that visual or interesting about, you know, sending an encrypted email.
Francis Rations, Visiotech Security.
Come in.
Can you check my credential fully, please, sir?
Of course.
A few weeks ago, the Department of Defense mandated a top-to-bottom security review of all private company contractors in the ballistic missile defense program. I'm going to need to ask you a few questions, sir.
Now, any script you write, as opposed to other people who write scripts for the show, needs to be read and approved by the CIA. Is that a pain in the ass? Has it been a pain in the ass?
Earlier in my career, when I was writing certain things, I did have some trouble with this process. I, for example, one time wrote a treatment for a show and sent it in to the Publications Review Board, which is a part of the CIA that handles this. And they just wrote back, you can't do that. So now in the end, I was able to sort of make some changes and massage it and work it out with them. But over the years, I started to figure out what types of things they have problems with and what types of things they don't. So the process has been very, very smooth on the Americans.
What kinds of things would they say no to?
I don't write anything about cover because I know from experience that details about CIA cover, details about how cover is used.
Meaning the fake jobs that people have.
Exactly. Details about that, they won't let anything by. I never mention it. I can mention it like this, but I wouldn't go into any detail with you or talk about that at all because that's one of their real sore spots.
You're starting your new season after the Winter Olympics in Russia. Is that going to be good for you as people are thinking about Russia and thinking about this newly belligerent, Putin-esque, kind of pseudo-Soviet Russia?
Well, you know, the moment it struck me that I realized that was all coinciding, I thought it was pretty great. And we're going to have some commercials on during the Olympics. And I thought, oh, it's all coming together nicely.
It's all – Putin is helping you. It's all part of a cross-promotional marketing plan.
I wonder all the time what Putin would think of the show. I can't figure out the answer to that.
Well, I look forward to this new season and keep making good shows.
Thanks so much, Kurt.
Joe Weisberg, thanks. Joe Weisberg is a co-creator of The Americans. The second season has just begun on FX.
I believe that harmonies are colors. Every time I paint, it sharpens my harmony.
Your love is bright as ever.
Yesterday I tried to paint you, but the colors weren't beautiful enough.
Even in the shadows.
Your love goes beyond what I can say. Love, Beyonce.
Baby, kiss me.
No, that was not a love letter Beyonce wrote me, unfortunately. It is the interlude from her album Dangerously in Love, where she talks about hearing colors. It almost seems these days like you can't work in pop music unless you've got synesthesia. Take a listen to some of this interview with Hit Boy, who is a producer responsible for, you know, hits by Kanye and Jay-Z and Beyonce herself.
You see, I've always liked the different sounds. Like, I can just, like, see them.
Uh-huh. You know, so what color is the bass kick?
It's, like, black, kind of, like, grayish.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And then a snare would be?
Snare is, like, white.
A hi-hat would be?
Like, silver.
Wow. You hear this?
Yeah.
And it's not just him. Pharrell and Frank Ocean and Blood Orange all claim to have the neurological disorder in which your senses blend together. Long before synesthesia became the ultimate pop music humble brag, Billy Joel and Stevie Wonder both claimed to see sound. In fact, people have been tasting shape and hearing colors for a long time. Synesthesia was first identified in the 1880s, but it's only recently that neuroscience has really been able to describe what's going on in the minds of the afflicted, or the blessed, depending on your point of view. Michael May has our story.
Artist Carol Steen sees sounds in color, also numbers and letters, too. When she was a little kid, she mentioned to a friend that the letter A was the prettiest pink.
And I was sure she would agree, but she stopped in her tracks, and she was silent for a minute. Seemed like a really long time. And then she just looked at me, scrunching up her face, and said, "You're weird."
And that, until very recently, pretty much summed up the scientific consensus on synesthesia. It was weird. A quirk. Some said it was caused by playing with colored refrigerator magnets as a child. Seriously, that was a theory. But in the 1990s, neuroscientist Richard Cytowic began to experiment on synesthetes and found it was surprisingly common. One out of 23 people have some form of it.
The received wisdom is that the senses travel along five channels, that there's no intercommunication among them. And that turns out not to be the case.
Synesthesia has become a hot research topic. In San Diego, neuroscientist V.S. Ramachandran recently sat down with a writer named Deborah Ginsberg.
What types of synesthesia do you experience?
The letters all have very distinct colors for me.
Okay.
Words for me are colors that are affected by the letters. Some letters have dominant colors.
Mm-hmm.
S's are very red, a deep red. O's are like an orangey
red. So if I say scoundrel.
Right. If you say scoundrel, it's a red word.
You see, people have heard this sort of thing in the past and then brushed it aside, saying that's crazy.
Well, everybody I speak to says it's crazy.
There's no pattern here. But if you look at different synesthetes, you find there are patterns. And science is all about looking for patterns in what seems chaotic. Periodic table, for example, all these elements, compounds all look crazy.
Right.
And then Mendeleev came and said, look, there is a pattern.
Ramachandran used brain imaging to see which areas of the brain lit up when synesthetes looked at letters and numbers. He found activity occurring in two little pieces of gray matter below the ear, the angular gyrus and the fusiform gyrus.
It has the number area in it. It also has the color area in it. And right next to each other, almost touching each other, the visual representation of numbers and the visual representation of colors. So we said, my God, this can't be a coincidence. These two areas are almost touching each other. They're in the same part of the brain called the fusiform gyrus. Maybe there is some cross-wiring going on there in these people. So every time they see a number, it evokes a particular color.
A fetus has millions of excess connections like this throughout its brain, but it's almost like the brain prunes itself as it develops. This keeps our senses separate, mostly. But synesthetes have a gene or genes that allow some of these branches to grow wild. But why? Richard Cytowic says that if a mutation doesn't disappear from the gene pool, It must be serving a purpose.
It's not just to make the world pretty for people who hear colors and taste shapes and see letters and numbers and colors. What is it doing for the rest of us?
V.S. Ramachandran has a clue. Synesthesia is 8 times more common in artists, writers, and musicians. And his theory is that those wild branches in synesthetes' brains help them create metaphors.
You've got excessive connections throughout the brain. That, in turn, provides a substrate, a neural substrate, gives you the opportunity to link seemingly unrelated ideas and concepts, which is the basis of metaphor. Like when you say, Juliet is the sun, you don't say, well, that means they're both, she's a hot, glowing ball of fire, which is what the sun is. You say, no, she's warm and nurturing, warm like the sun, nurturing like the sun, radiant like the sun. Your brain makes the appropriate links. And those links are more pronounced in synesthetes.
A brain mutation that makes you deep and creative. There's no question. Synesthesia is probably the sexiest neurological phenomenon around.
Then people say, well, if it's that good, why doesn't everybody have it? Well, the answer is you don't want everybody to be creative. If there's a neurosurgeon operating on your brain, you don't want them getting creative on you. So you need creative people. You need diversity of the gene pool. You need creative people. You need very straight-laced, down-to-earth, hard-nosed types.
But even neurosurgeons understand metaphors. We talk about bright music as if those treble tones could blind you. And we recognize loud ties and the smell of sharp cheese. Ramachandran believes synesthesia provides clues not only into how we process these metaphors, but even into how language was created.
So here you're moving all the way from molecules to higher level mental phenomena like creativity and abstract thinking.
Ramachandran uses an experiment to prove his point. He took 2 words that are meaningless in most languages.
Booba, kiki.
Booba and kiki. He showed them to people and asked them to match the words to either a round shape or a jagged shape. People across the world say kiki is sharp like shattered glass, and booba is round and blobby as an amoeba.
And the reason is the brain looks at the curved shapes and it mimics the curvature of the sound, booba, and the tongue undulating on the palate like a booba, and links these and say, what do they have in common? The boobaness. And if the angular digitis is damaged, we found that people are bad at metaphor. People are also bad at cross-modal abstraction like kiki and booba.
Writer Deborah Ginsberg consciously uses her synesthetic perception in her writing. A fire erupts in her most recent novel, and she chose red and hot words for the scene.
The I, the long I sound in fire. Now, I for me is white, but when you make it a long I sound, it becomes a very bright and hot feeling letter.
From what you're saying so far, it looks as though the synesthetic evoked colors actually blend metaphorically into each other and create pleasing resonances. And this is the key to the whole thing. From our framework, from the standpoint of what I've been saying, this is beautiful.
In other words, synesthetes might be visualizing emotional qualities of words and shapes that the rest of us can feel, but wouldn't necessarily think of. So here's to words like acrobat that flip across the tongue, Rothko paintings that emit a dark drone, and Miles Davis trumpet lines that scorch the night sky like a comet. For Studio 360, I'm Michael May.
You can see a slideshow of Carol Steen's artwork at studio360.org. Still ahead in this hour of Studio 360, the playwright Terrell Alvin McCraney takes Shakespeare's Antony and Cleopatra out of the Roman Empire and transplants it to colonial Haiti, on the verge of black revolution against the French.
I wanted to place it somewhere that we could see it and feel it, and it could be alive in the room.
That's next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Your private Cleopatra.
Stay with us.
Just for your pleasure, whatever you wish, babe.
This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. Terrell Alvin McCraney's resume is like a playwright's dream. He got his MFA from Yale. He apprenticed under August Wilson. He's a member of the Steppenwolf Theater Company. He's been in residence at the Royal Shakespeare Company, and last year he won a MacArthur Genius Grant, all before he turned 33. And now McCraney, who people talk about becoming the greatest playwright of his generation, turns his attention to the greatest of all time. McCraney is the editor and director of a new production of Shakespeare's Antony and Cleopatra, which is playing now at the Public Theater in New York. Terrell McCraney, welcome to Studio 360.
And thank you so much for having me.
So, Mark Antony and Cleopatra lived in Rome and Egypt 2 millennia ago. You set your version in French colonial Haiti 2 centuries ago. Explain yourself.
Explain myself. Well, the play was a commission from the Royal Shakespeare Company and the Public Theater here in New York. And the idea was to create a version of the play that could be played with 10 actors, but also would allow it to be what it was designed to be, a history and a tragedy. And I wanted to place it somewhere that the history felt alive and visceral, something that people didn't have to run to their phones and Google the understandings or the relationships between Pompey and Octavius, but understand the colonial relationship between the two nations. And so for me, I wanted to place it somewhere that we could see it and feel it, and it could be alive in the room and sort of instantaneous in a way.
I mean, it's one thing to say Midsummer Night's Dream wherever, whenever, but when you're dealing with historical figures, that must be trickier.
It can be. I mean, we also know of a very incredible production of Richard III that was done in Nazi Germany. I mean, the great thing about history, sometimes the most tragic thing about history, is that it repeats itself. And we recognize that we see these patterns in human behavior over and over again. And so putting a history in another portion of history only highlights that that history is still being made.
Actually, that brings up my favorite quote ever attributed to Mark Twain, which is that history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. Mm. And I guess this it definitely does that.
Yes. Well, we try.
I want to play a scene from this current Royal Shakespeare Company production that's playing in New York. We are going to hear Act 5, Scene 2, if you can set it up for us.
Cleopatra is surrounded by soldiers, and she has been taken, basically, prisoner. And Mark Antony is given the ghost, and now she's fighting for her own freedom.
I dreamed there was an Emperor Antony. His face was as the heavens, and therein stuck a sun and moon, which kept their course and lighted the little old earth.
Most sovereign creature.
His legs bestrid the ocean. His reared arm crested the world. His voice was propertied as all the tuned spheres, and that to friends. But when he meant to quail and shake the orb, he was as rattling thunder.
Cleopatra.
Think you there was? Or might be such a man as this I dreamed of.
Gentle madam, no.
You lie up to the hearing of the gods.
That was Gioacchino Colucango and Henry Stram in Antony and Cleopatra, edited and directed by Terrell Alvin McCraney, who is here with me. So what does it mean exactly to edit Shakespeare?
Well, I think most Shakespeare is edited these days.
Although you're billed, which is unusual, as the editor.
Right, because I did a lot of editing.
You reordered things.
Necessarily, yeah, because we definitely had 10 actors instead of the 44 or at least 17 to do the play with.
Yeah, you had a lot of people playing three roles, which is unusual.
Yes, definitely. What I think was interesting about the project is that we wanted it to be movable. A movable feast that we could take from the UK to Miami and reside then here in New York City, which
right.
We've done. And it's difficult to take a company of 44 or even 17, and we had to go with a number that we thought we could sustain for those 3 playing stations.
You had barely gotten your master's from Yale in 2007 when theaters around America and England started producing the brother-sister plays, your trilogy of plays, which is set in the Louisiana Bayou. With some characters that go from play to play and lots of common themes. But they are 3 very distinct plays. If you could describe them, if I meet you on a plane and I say, what do you do? And you I'm a playwright. Oh, what are your plays?
Well, first of all, I'd never say that. If you said, what do you do? I would go, I'm an artist.
But then I would say, oh, what's your art like? Anyhow, how would you describe these three plays in a couple of sentences?
I would describe them as an opportunity to look into working class African-American lives.
I want to play a scene from the last play in the trilogy, which is called Marcus or the Secret of Sweet. And this is a story of a young man coming of age and coming out as well.
Enter.
The boys.
In this class of language, there are boys from all the teams. Focus.
They sit behind Marcus.
From basketball to track, varsity to junior.
Whispering.
Marcus.
And every Monday Marcus. While the pop quizzes line the desks.
Hey, Marcus.
The boys all leaning a little closer. Marcus. Trying to pick up the answers that Marcus slinging down.
Marcus Eschew.
They make propositions.
Hey.
Whispering hush teacher can't hear tones.
Let me see.
The heads yanking their mouths smile.
Mark.
Motioning for me to move my head.
Move your hand. Move.
Whispering.
Marcus.
Marcus.
Focus.
But see, all they want are the answers to the test.
Focus.
Answers that will make it easier to get back to track and field.
Focus.
But Marcus's mind is wishing that their heads were yanking and their mouths were asking.
Focus, Marcus.
So let me come over.
Focus.
Let me step closer.
Focus.
Let me.
That was from the MacArthur Theater production of Marcus or the Secret of Sweet.
I like that scene.
It's a great scene.
Oh, thanks. I didn't remember I liked it so much.
Well, there you go. It gives the listener a sense of a thing you do a lot in these plays, which is have the characters narrate their actions before they do them as though they're reading stage directions. How did you and why did you develop that device?
Well, the plays all feel like and deal with theater in a way that has much more of a storytelling element to it. And I wanted to keep that element as alive as possible. These stories came to me in a storytelling mode, and I thought that they would be best experienced that way. So you felt an instant connection with the actors because they weren't anywhere but in the room with you, explaining to you or telling you or guiding you through these very complicated lives.
So tell me about this trilogy. You're from Miami. Mm-hmm. What inspired you to set these stories, these plays, in rural Louisiana?
I've been spending more time not just in Louisiana, but sort of in the bayou and in the sort of backwoods of Alabama and Georgia and Florida.
Why?
Because that's where most of my family's from.
Uh-huh.
And also because it's just beautiful country to visit. It's a part of the country that we rarely see or hear of until it's being, you know, drowned by hurricanes or floods or something. And it was compelling me to talk about the stories and ghosts and things that I was hearing about, learning about then. But it was also interesting to me that especially in the Red and Brown Water comes from
which is the title of the first play in the trilogy.
That swamp Everglades look that looks like brown water that you could probably stand on. And you probably could on certain places, but then all of a sudden that water drops down to about 15 feet and how treacherous that life could be. Living in places where you thought you were on dry land, when in a second you aren't anymore.
And speaking of writing about what you know, the character Marcus from the scene we heard a little earlier is this young man who's discovering that he's gay. How autobiographical is this?
Not at all.
Really?
I mean, other than I'm gay and black. I wish my coming out experience were like Marcus's. Marcus is also, I mean, the main secret of his suite is that he has a connection to another world and that he ushers in these dreams that somehow seem prophetic, and he's trying to find his way or his place in his community.
Really? And you don't think of your playwriting as some more worldly version of that kind of prophetic impulse?
No. No, I don't think my plays are snatched down from some sort of...
I'm not saying place. Literally.
Oh, yeah. See, but that's the problem. But I think literally Marcus is spiritually connected to his community in the way, and he's trying to figure it out. I have written things that are autobiographical. They just are boring, so I never make them plays.
Whether or not your life makes for great theater, it would make for a great biopic because you had this really rough life. Your mother was an addict and died when you were young and she was young.
Sure. I mean, my mother died when I was my last year at DePaul. But she was sick for a long time, and that was pretty hard on the whole family. And I lived with my dad when I was in high school, and that was pretty rough because my dad wasn't necessarily as excited about the arts as everybody else was. But I don't
think— Because he just thought it was a waste of your time, or—
Well, when you grow up poor, you sort of hope that your kid will grow up and be a lawyer or a doctor. And knowing what we know about society, if they live past 25, you just hope they have some skill to sort of make their life a little easier. And I think he was worried about that. He also could tell that I was gay or at least gay identifying at some point. And he was worried about that as well, which is, you know, understandable in the neighborhood and environment we grew up in.
He must be pleased with your success.
He's pleased and surprised, as we all are, I think.
Was there some point at which you, in addition to saying, oh, I can do this the rest of my life, where you realized I can really shoot for the heights and the brass ring and I can go to Yale and I can be a producer to the public and all that?
I said a very simple prayer one night, which was, if you allow me to continue to work hard, meaning not starve to death, I will continue to work hard. And so I do continue to work hard.
So you've been working on this Antony and Cleopatra for a while now. I mean, is it okay, directing, this is great, fine, but I want to get back in my room and write some plays?
I want to get back in my room and sleep. You think that's funny, but I'm dead serious. I want to go to sleep. So I want to go home at night and not, you know, rattle over lines and sort of go, oh, yes, that line, yes, that lighting time, that water cue, that, you know, it's sort of, you know, one of those moments.
So I can imagine.
Yeah, so.
Well, good luck and get some sleep.
Well, thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
Terrell Alvin McCraney's take on Antony and Cleopatra is at the Public Theater in New York City through the end of March. And speaking of directing Shakespeare, before we go, a story from one of our listeners, Christine Chapman in Port Clinton, Ohio, who always wanted to do exactly that. But with a day job and family obligations, she could never make the dream a reality.
I had been running a real estate company for a decade. And while I had been always involved in theater, trying to keep my toe in at least so I couldn't feel like I was completely cut off, then I had my daughter. And for the next almost 7 years, I didn't do anything. That was killing me. It was an evening in May in 2002. I jumped in the car and started driving. I needed out in a really big way. A half hour from where I live in Sandusky, there is a Cineplex that was showing a movie I kept seeing ads for, The Rookie. I figured it would be something I would never see until it came to video, because there's that little cynical soundtrack in your head going, oh yeah, you're going to go watch a G-rated Disney movie. But there wasn't anybody with me. And I'll admit to being a Dennis Quaid fan, and I didn't have to tell anyone I went. So I went to the movie theater and bought my ticket, went in to find I was the only person there. I kind of waited around, half expected an usher to come tell me we're sorry we've canceled the show because we only sold one ticket, but they didn't. And they started rolling the film. About 15 minutes into the movie, Dennis Quaid, who plays Jim Morris, a guy who was a baseball player turned chemistry teacher and high school baseball coach, has a conversation with his son,
Daddy?
In which his son wants to know how long it's been since his shoulder injury hurt.
Why do you want to know?
So that he could gauge why it kept him out of his shot at the majors.
Is that why he didn't make it?
And Dennis Quaid's answer is,
it's never one thing.
It's never only one thing. Wow. How many excuses have I made? How many times did I turn away from something that was an option because I thought it wasn't practical? And I was done in from there. I just started crying and for some odd reason decided I wanted to direct Shakespeare in the Park. I called up the local city of Port Clinton. They put me on with the mayor of Port Clinton, Tom Brown, who luckily I know. In Port Clinton, you kind of all know the mayor. And asked, hey, I'm thinking I might want to do a theater company outside in the park, free to the public. Do you think this is something I could do? and he went nuts for that idea. Oh, what can we help you with? Within 2 months after that conversation with the mayor, I had formed the Lake Spear Theater Festival, and we played to wonderful audiences in Port Clinton. I regularly have to pinch myself. You know, once you actually jump on the wave and ride it, whoosh, it takes you even farther than you could have imagined.
That's Christine Chapman of Port Clinton, Ohio. Our story was produced by Studio 360's Jonathan Mitchell. And that's it for this hour of Studio 360. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you'll listen again next time. And remember, Oscar night is also Oscar bingo night. Play interactive bingo with us during the broadcast, real time and Twitterized. Get your cards at studio360.org. Oscar night also happens to be the deadline for our Wes Craven Scary Short Film Fest. It's only got to be 30 seconds long, and you've still got days to become an auteur. Do it. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Ital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisferam,
Alana Harper,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Rose Connolly,
Eliza Martin,
Andres O'Hara Plotnick.
And thanks to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tiegum.
Studio 360 is supported in part by the SC Group, whose charitable resources include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds at fjc.org, and by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, ArtWorks.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360,
oh, son.
The king of reality TV takes on the king of kings.
Lady, I believe your son is the promised king of his people.
Mark Burnett brings the New Testament to the big screen.
What is his name?
Jesus.
That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.